Hey everyone, before we get into this recording, first off, this is episode number 346. You'll know why I mentioned that in a second. And also, we forgot to go over Max's upcoming RKC and HKC dates that are going to be coming up for him. So again, just make sure you go over to maxshank.com. You can see all those other dates on there as well, because he's going to be doing certifications for those throughout the year. I forgot to bring those up. I wanted to get into more kettlebell discussion in there, but that's the great thing about podcasts is that there's another one around the corner. So I'm sure we'll be talking to him again soon. So I hope you enjoy the episode. And also, this is going to be the last week that people can submit their entries for that awesome Polar heart rate monitor, that A300 heart rate monitor. This is just for Patreon supporters as a thank you for supporting me. And I really appreciate it. If you have not started being a Patreon supporter, if you go check that out at patreon.com/thefitcast, literally a dollar per episode makes a big difference. And you know, I want to keep the show going, and this helps me set aside the time to do so. So I appreciate everyone that is supporting the show. It means so, so much. You wouldn't even believe how much it means that you guys think it's worth supporting. So, thank you. I'm going to stop talking and we're going to get into the show. Hope you enjoy it. Hello, welcome back to the FitCast. I don't know what episode number this is because I'm recording a ton of episodes in advance to make sure that new episodes are coming to you every single week. But that's why, you know, hopefully if you're able to look down at your phone or your iPod or your laptop or whatever device you're using to listen to this, you'll know what episode this is. Anyways, I'm Kevin Larrabee and I'm very happy to have back on the show the author of Ultimate Athleticism and just... literally, I think I mentioned this last time on the show, it's the example that Mike Boyle gives for one of the strongest human beings that he knows, and that's Max Shank. Max, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Kev. Glad to be back.
You got to, like, talk to Mike about getting some kind of, you know, payment for every time he uses that video in his talks. Like, some kind of, like...
I need a royalty plan.
That's what I was looking for. Yeah, you need to get some royalties from Mike just because of the, you know, just the... kind of the poster boy that you are for all the single leg stuff that he's talking about in his lectures.
Oh man, yeah, maybe you can put in a good word for me.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do. I know we got Perform Better Summit coming up in just a couple days here in Providence, and are you thinking about going to the one in Long Beach that I guess is in the first week of August?
Yeah, I'm actually all signed up for that one as well.
Awesome. Well, I will see you there, and hopefully. If you guys hear this before that, make sure to go up to Max and say hi. And, you know, again, maybe that is the time to call Mike out during the talk and just say,
perfect.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just like cut a check right there.
That's a very good idea.
But we got a lot of great stuff to talk about for this episode. We got some great feedback from the first time that you were on. And just a quick heads up, you know, since then, Ultimate Athleticism has now come out in print, and you can actually grab it really easily on Amazon right now. It's like $27, and you can get that in the printed form, so you don't have to go down to Staples and print that thing out. What was that process like? Was it pretty easy to get it into print?
You know, I have to say the hardest part wasn't actually doing all the stuff for Amazon. It was just the getting the layout of the book right and getting all those things on my end done. The Amazon part made it very easy, actually.
Yeah, they seem to have a really good process for getting independent authors set up these days. So yeah, head over to Amazon and check that out if you're someone that likes the more physical version of your reading material. But before we actually started recording, we got into a discussion because you're looking to expand your gym. You're going to be taking on, you know, a bunch of new people at your facility because another facility nearby shut down. So let's talk a little bit about that first. You know, what are your thoughts in terms of expanding? What are the things that you need to look at before, you know, making that big leap to or that investment to expand your gym? And then, you know, what you're going to do in terms of taking on that new population and bringing them into your training methodology.
Well, I guess we can start with the expansion part. And I'm pretty, I'm very financially conservative. So I always try to make sure that I can easily handle whatever additional costs. are going to come from the expansion. So I have to already have a big monthly surplus to handle the added monthly expense. I don't want to go into it thinking, oh, well, if I spend this and then I make this much extra, then I can make it work. I think people who put themselves in that position do one of two things. It's either good because it lights a fire under their ass, mm-hmm. or they go bankrupt. So I think the risk reward just isn't quite there. And me being a little bit more on the safe side of things, I just want to make sure that I'm kind of bursting at the seams already and from an income standpoint before I decide to expand. So I'm very cautious taking these steps.
So what kind of square footage are you at right now?
We're at 2,000 square feet of gym area, mm-hmm. not including like the offices and the bathrooms and things like that. And we're going to add another 1,000 in the next month or so here. Let's see. Yeah, probably right around when we'll come up on our 6 years, which will be this August. So that's pretty cool.
So what do you have to look at when it comes to the expansion? Are you going to be expanding like your turf area? Is it going to be more room for just weights and things like that and like rubber flooring?
You know, our turf area is pretty good size. It's about 800 square feet.
Nice.
Yeah. Our whole second room, which sort of comes in rooms, is basically all turf with just some platforms on the edge. And the third room is going to be some more racks and bars and more rubber for the most part. Really, I think as most gym owners who are into like the whole functional training kind of thing will acknowledge, empty space is the most valuable resource for a gym. I mean, we're not trying to clog it up with stuff. As long as the equipment can be hung on the wall, basically, or stuffed up against the wall, that's really the best case scenario.
So what kind of equipment are you looking at outside of, I mean, I know you got racks, you got, you know, your kettlebells, your dumbbells, your implements and sleds and stuff like that. What do you have outside of that?
Well, you know, from an equipment standpoint, it all depends on who your clientele is. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a pretty wide range of clientele, but for the most part, it's probably about 60% women from 30 to 60 or so. And I know that's kind of a big range, but that's sort of where we're at. Mm-hmm. And depending on what their goals are, really the only reason you need a barbell is for deadlifting. And some people just simply don't want to. We have kettlebells that go up to 200 pounds. And that really, it kind of sets people up for a much safer and easier learning curve on the deadlift. Mm-hmm. So from my perspective, I don't even let girls use a barbell on their back unless they've already demonstrated some rock solid goblet squats with like at least the 90 pound bell. Mm-hmm. And usually, like I sort of mentioned before, there's really no reason if their goal is just have fun, be safe, get stronger and look better that they need to sort of go outside that comfort zone of just mostly body weight and free weights. So the most useful pieces of equipment, in my opinion, are going to be gymnastics rings, bands, kettlebells, and open space. And then from there, dumbbells too, actually, when you get right down to it. From there, then you can start expanding into things that are also maybe a little bit more specialized and fun, like pushing sled, barbells, things like that. So it's kind of like an outward moving circle. Because one of the things that makes exercise sustainable is the fact that it's fun and safe, right? So those are kind of like the two main things for the average exerciser. That's why they keep coming back. So you start with that like core group of equipment that you need, and then you kind of expand outward into stuff that's maybe just novel and fun, but still at the same time effective, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's so funny when I get a lot of people that ask me about like home gym stuff because I train like at least twice a week at home, and how to translate what we do at like MBSC or what they would be doing at your facility at your house. And it really is like just what you said. You don't need a lot. It's like, you know, you get a couple kettlebells, you get some bands, and you know, you can get a chin up bar and you can get some rings, and you get a pretty good setup for a lot of variety, a great training session. And then if you really need to, you can go into the crazy stuff like adding in a sled, or like even battling ropes are not very expensive. So you can get pretty broad without putting in a ton of investment.
Yeah, I mean, I think fitness is actually pretty simple as long as you're not hurt. Yeah. I mean, we kind of already inherently know what works and what doesn't work. Like, the people who you know that are really flexible were either born that way or they spend a decent amount of time working on it. Mm-hmm. The people who are really strong at deadlifting probably do a decent bit of deadlifting. You know, people who are good at doing pull-ups and push-ups, guess what? They do a lot of push-ups all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no real, like, secret. It's just how much time are you willing to invest in each of those things. And if you're not willing to invest a lot of time, then you need to make sure that you're very efficient with that time you spend.
Well, let's talk about, you know, with this expansion, you're taking on, I think you were saying, like, three, maybe up to, like, 300 new people coming into your facility, coming off of maybe not the best coaching and programming. What are you kind of seeing from these people that you're looking at? And I guess, how are you going to plan on addressing some of the deficiencies in their movement?
Well, it's pretty certain that not all 300 are going to come over. That's for sure. So far this past month, we've had about 60 people come in. And what I noticed is, we were talking earlier off the air. Is this called the air? Do we get to say off the air if it's just a podcast? I think we should.
Yeah, it translates. You know,
we're. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we're on the air right now. Okay. What we were saying before is that, you know, the barrier to entry for opening a gym is so low. And it was obvious at the other gym. So this is the hardest part, is getting them sort of up to speed from a movement standpoint, just to start joining the gym at all. And obviously you want to be as accommodating as possible, but it's really difficult. So the guy who owned the gym before, he was a fighter, actually, and he won a fight and he had some money left over. So he started a gym. Now, he doesn't know anything about training specifically. And actually before, we made the transition, I went over to take a couple classes, and you know what, it became obvious to me that for some people, this is just a job. And I think that's the big distinction. I know it's probably the same for you, but for me, when I go home, I leave the gym, I'm still reading and writing about this field.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, we don't really turn it off. And there are some people who are just like, you know, a gym seems like a good idea. Maybe I'll open a gym. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the impression I got, is the education there was very low. And unfortunately, the average consumer doesn't really understand the difference, because they just see, oh, this made me tired and sore. That must be good for me. Right? And burning calories is really just like a zero-sum game. Like, you can never burn enough calories and have it be sustainable to be in the shape you want to be in. Because all that time you spent just burning calories for the sake of burning calories was misery. And there are so many things you can do that might actually be of a benefit to you, like learning a skill or doing something you actually enjoy, that will just happen to burn some calories. So it's really, I think, important to get people to understand the distinction that every time they're burning calories is the same as a person just killing time. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, killing time is like the stupidest thing you can do, because it's the only thing we can't get more of.
Right.
So that lack of education there translated into a lack of movement literacy for all these potential new members. So part of the reason the business shut down was because they were doing what a lot of businesses do. They were just dropping their prices so low that anyone would try to get a membership, basically. They were charging like $80 a month and giving discounts for paying in full, knowing that they were going to go out of business, actually, which is a little shady, of course. Right. But so they were charging like almost nothing for, you know, 1,000 classes. So of course they went out of business, because they just weren't able to cover the rent and the salaries of all the trainers and things like that. So from a business standpoint, it wasn't good either. But from a coaching standpoint, there was no rhyme or reason to the training. It was very random. and there was no heed paid to learning how to hip hinge or learning how to do a proper push-up or even a pull-up or really anything. So what we've noticed bringing these people in is that we have to really kind of start from scratch. And the biggest barrier is that a lot of people aren't willing to do that. Mm-hmm. They sort of have this idea that they're already in really good shape and they don't need these remedial exercises. But you look at someone who's doing a deadlift with all of the weight on the balls of their feet, their back is rounded, and their butt is almost touching their heels. You know, it's like insane, but that's probably the most prevalent quality that I've found is no one knows how to use their glutes. Mm-hmm. And this is something I even talk about in my book a great deal, is people don't know how to use their lats and people don't know how to use their glutes. And those are the two biggest muscles in the upper and lower body respectively. So obviously that creates a major problem when you want to lift some big weights.
So, I mean, it's funny that you bring this up, because it's like, I see it a lot at our gym when we get young athletes that come in that have either had like their football coach was their strength and conditioning coach, or even like their father or something like that. And they come into our gym and they're like, oh, well, no, I've been doing it this way for like the last couple of years. And you kind of have to almost say in the politest way possible, how far has that gotten you? Or like, same thing when I was doing, you know, personal training back before I was at MBSC, people would come and be like, oh, well, you know, I never, you know, did this before. You know, why aren't we doing it this other way? It's like, well, how far did that get you? It got you to the point where you came to me to then ask for additional help. So do you see like you're going to have to do a lot of just really in a really polite way, just trying to help them understand that they need to be doing things a different way. And it seems like for you, it's going to be mostly on just like teaching them how to hip hinge and not just be so knee dominant.
Yeah. I mean, it's an entire re-education thing too, because you not only have to change their movement, but you have to change their idea of what exercise is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So they're under the impression that if I sweat and I have my legs burning and I feel like I might die, that is the indicator of a good workout. Now, of course, you and I know that that extra effort is negligible from an overall benefit standpoint. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you just use your common sense, think about it. What do most people need more of? They need more good quality movement. They need more flexibility. And the amount of extra calories they'll burn from doing dumb shit will be negligible. But the benefits they get from feeling better and moving better, and the hormonal cascade that will happen because of those new things, it'll be much more benefit in the long term. But you have to teach people that, because any idiot can sit there with a stopwatch and say, do squat jumps for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that will make anybody sore. There's no one on the world who's going to do 5 minutes of squat jumps where they jump as high as they can and not be completely wrecked.
So, yeah, I guess, this might be like a bad analogy, but it's almost like trying to teach a dog that you adopt that's been abused forever, that, you know, you're not going to hit the dog every time you want to just pat him on the head. And
the sad part is that's actually a pretty good analogy.
I know it's, and I hate thinking of it, but, you know, I think, you know, we like our methodology at MBSC and yours seems to be very similar, where we're kind of looking for, minimal effective dosage, so we can make sure that they come in for the next session and they're not going to feel like a truck hit them. And, you know, at the same time, just trying to, I mean, that's really what you're doing, is trying to maximize their quality of movement. And in turn, that is going to greatly improve their quality of life.
Yeah. And one thing I've also done, because I'm also a realist at heart, and I understand that there's a certain population who really craves that sort of high they get from high intensity exercise, you know, and that's just a reality. I know a lot of people like that. So what I've done is I've put an extra credit option for extra conditioning if people want to do it. Mm-hmm. And it's short, but it's intense, but it's also deliberately choosing exercises that take almost no skill whatsoever. because that makes it safe again. When you take something that's a high skill maneuver and you do it at a high intensity, people get injured, right?
Yeah. So what examples do you have for that?
A couple of my favorite examples are pushing the sled and riding the airdyne.
Right.
You know, worst thing that happens if you're riding the airdyne is probably that you vomit. And if you're pushing the sled, probably the worst thing that happens is the sled stops moving if you get too tired. You know, I mean, both of those are very safe exercises. What I don't want to gloss over is that as your movement literacy increases, you can add more things to that sort of conditioning or high intensity part of your workout. You know what I mean? Like, there are a lot of people at the gym who can do heavy kettlebell swings for cardio and burpees for cardio because their movement and their mastery of those exercises is so solid. But most people obviously can't. You know what I mean?
I gotcha. You mentioned before that like 60% of the people that are coming through your door are females. How did that happen? Because it seems to be still like in our environment, it's at NBSC, it's getting to be more like 50-50, but that seems pretty impressive. Is that something that you're kind of marketing towards more of like a female clientele?
You know, it's something that I haven't tried to force one way or the other. One thing I've learned is that I don't understand women. So I will just adapt to the situation. And it just so happens that I think women are more receptive of coaching. Mm-hmm. And they're maybe more geared toward trying a group fitness type of class. At least the kind of things that we offer. And actually, you know, I really get a lot of enjoyment more seeing some girls being able to knock out their first pull-ups for the first time.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. I think that's just super awesome. And then, you know, watching just all these ladies doing, you know, well over 200-pound deadlifts and swinging 100 pounds like it was no big deal and making it look good. So, yeah, it's something that wasn't really on purpose, but that's just sort of the way it is now.
Yeah, you're totally right. I think it's just it's just a sense for some women to see what they're actually capable of and them not even having any sense of what they're capable of before walking through that door. But when you see them do something like a 28 kg get up at 110 pounds or doing, you know, knocking out a couple body weight chin ups, and then that it's just how empowering it is for women and for men that are coming in. It's just something that is, it's like why we do this, right?
Without a doubt. And just to sort of finish that thought that I had before, as far as the conditioning is concerned, I feel like every movement you do has to pass through several stages of a workout. So when you first learn a movement or when you're trying it for the first time, when do you want to plug that into your workout? The beginning or the end?
If you're learning something, you want to throw it in at the beginning.
At the beginning, right? Because that's when you have the most energy.
Exactly.
So what I think is that each skill you learn starts in the very beginning. And then as you develop a higher level of mastery with it, it sort of slides down to the end of a workout. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So for example, you know, teaching someone a push-up, something as simple as that passes through several stages. First, it's a skill exercise because you just have to figure it out. Next, it's a strength exercise. And last, it can be an accessory work or eventually a conditioning exercise. You know, it just goes through all those stages.
Yeah, I think we see that, you know, a lot with the single-legged dove too, obviously. Just for a lot of people that, you know, it's part of our warm-up. But for a lot of people, it's just even that body weight single-legged deadlift continues to be not only their warm-up but their strength exercise for a couple months until they can figure out how to get that movement down.
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. I think there's so much just awesomeness in that movement for most people. It does so many good things that you just – I can't imagine not having it as part of the program, quite honestly.
What about like Turkish get-ups? How are you liking to, or how do you teach that when someone new comes on? How do you break it up?
Well, I've spent a good amount of time teaching a lot of people get-ups over the years, and I think the most important thing is to teach it without a weight and break it up into halves. So when you first teach someone, don't even show them the whole movement because they'll get intimidated and confused. Mm-hmm. You just show them the part where they go up to the hand.
Right.
So they roll up to the elbow, up to the hand. You can have them do a bridge there if you're into that, which we are. And then you have them come back down. And you have them do several rounds of that before you even indicate that there is a second part to it. Mm-hmm. And not using a weight makes it a little bit less scary as well. So that's probably the key there.
Do you have them balance anything? Like, I know in the past we've tried using things like shoes or like an Erics pad or something like that, so they can at least make sure that they're keeping, you know, their arm, I guess, perpendicular to the ground at all times.
Yeah, we usually use a yoga block for that. That works pretty well. Yeah.
So if people have been following you on Facebook and in other social media outlets, you've been posting a lot of the 5-minute flows. So I would love if you could talk a little bit about that. How did that idea come along? And, you know, really just, you know, what the whole methodology is behind that.
Sure. Basically, it came around as an answer to what's the best thing a person can do that's also the easiest. Because I find that the most difficult part, starting a new exercise plan or flexibility regimen or whatever, is all about sticking with it. Mm-hmm. So I've done a lot of reading into, you know, habit formation and things like that as well, because that's really what it all is. And it's important to consider that if you do something every day, you get to keep doing it for the rest of your days. That's basically how it works. If you did it yesterday, you get to do it tomorrow. Simple as that. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make it an easy habit. I wanted it to be extremely effective, and I wanted it to have no barriers to doing it. So there's no equipment required. There's no specific amount of time. I really put 5 minutes as like sort of an average. But I tell people all the time that if you start with 2 minutes of unrehearsed, unscripted movement and then drink like 20 to 24 ounces of water, it will make your entire day significantly better. Something simple as that. And there are a couple reasons why I prefer to have it be unscripted movement, because it's also stimulating your brain to problem solve and plan ahead on the go and things like that. So it's kind of like a mental pick-me-up, as well as a physical pick-me-up. And what I've been doing is just offering ideas about what to do. Simplest thing is move your joints in circles. Simple. If you know nothing else, just start making circles with your wrists, your elbows, shoulders, hips, knees, ankles. Simple as that. And the feedback I've gotten has been insane so far, with just such small amount of time investment. And you can actually see the evolution where all these people are adopting this habit and saying, oh, it's so hard to stick with only 5 minutes now. Some people have actually given up coffee. They feel like they don't need coffee in the morning when they move and drink some water instead. Several people have mentioned that pain they've had for years has just completely gone away. And it's funny because I'm not even saying, hey, specifically do this move or specifically do this move. All I'm saying is, from a logistics standpoint, you need to just dedicate a little bit of your time every day to preserving your orthopedic health and staying hydrated.
So the problem that I run into is I get out of bed, I put some food in my dog's bowl, I make a couple cups of green tea, I sit down at the computer and answer emails before I walk my dog. So this is something that I got to start doing, is just like, as soon as you get out of bed, just do, you know, maybe I'll still feed my dog. I'll still throw some, you know, food in his bowl and then do 5 minutes of movement and check back in with you. Because I think this is the problem, is that people like think it's 5 minutes. What's that really going to do, Max? Is that really going to help me, like 5 minutes? Like, people think like they need to go and have like even more of an investment, but 5 minutes is just about right to get the ball rolling.
Yeah. And even if you just did 1 or 2 minutes, because that's even more manageable. If you say, oh, I don't have 5 whole minutes, which by the way, if you don't have 5 minutes, you got to seriously reevaluate your day.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, I mean, start with 1 or 2 minutes even, and it really does make a difference. I mean, I could say what a difference it's made for me, which it has, but I'd rather list all the benefits that these other people have seen, you know, more flexibility, more energy throughout the day, just overall better feeling of well-being. Just, it's just really been awesome. And, it's so easy that literally anyone can do it. And that was another part of why I put this out there, is when I wrote Ultimate Athleticism, I have progressions from like super level zero all the way up to doing crazy shit. But not everybody even wants to do that. So if I can make something, you know, fun and mentally stimulating and interesting and really easy for anybody to do, I feel like I can sort of help more people that way.
Well, people want to check it out. You guys do have a Facebook group at 5-Minute Morning Movement. Just search for that at the top of the Facebook page, and you can check out all of Max's videos with ideas of how to get started with this in your morning. And this is my pledge. I'm going to start doing this tomorrow morning. I'm going to put this is where I'm at in my life, where I just got to like have a reminder for like 6 a.m. when I wake up and just put it on my phone and say like, remind me at 6 a.m. to do 5 minutes of movement and get the ball rolling. Because it's terrible. Like I literally like go sit at my computer and I hunch over at my computer after laying down for, you know, 7 hours or whatever, and start answering emails while I wait for caffeine to kick in, then walk my dog. It's not optimal.
Right. What I would suggest you do though is do something that's actually important to you. Like, don't just move for the sake of movement. Think about what kind of movement things that you want to improve. And actually, as you start doing it, you'll notice throughout your 5 minute flow, if something feels tight, if something feels loose, if something feels good, if something feels not so good, and you'll actually be able to have a much better overall body awareness, which is going to enhance your strength, your flexibility, your coordination, basically every athletic quality you want, just from discovering your body a little better.
I'm curious, along with this, what have you been reading that you seem that you think has been you know, good in terms of behavior change and modifications?
You know, there are several. One book that I was reading that's more of like it's actually not even a book I would recommend most people read because it's intimidating and daunting, but it's from an economist named Thomas Sowell. It's called Intellectuals in Society. And basically it just shows all these statistics about these different things that we've done over the years and what those ramifications have been. And I think that for me, because my traditional schooling was in economics, I'm really all about the logistics before the specifics. And what I mean by that is it's important to spend 5 minutes dedicated toward flexibility more than specifically what you're doing with those 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's always logistics and then specifics. I like to, when I'm teaching people how to write programs, I have people make a pie chart of their day. So everything you do in your day, you make a pie chart. So if you work out an hour every single day, that's 4% of your day. You with me?
I got you.
Okay. So then you take that 4% slice and then you make a new pie chart and you put percentages based on what you're doing with that hour. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully whatever your goals are the biggest part of that pie. And if they're not, then you need to change something. It's as simple as that. It's all about how you invest your time.
Do you make suggestions on how people form those goals? Like, if someone just comes in and says, like, my goal is like fat loss or something like that, do you have them narrow that in a little bit?
You know, I try to encourage some sort of counterpart, non-aesthetic based goal to go along with their aesthetic based goal. Like, trust me, I'm not against looking good. I mean, who doesn't want to look good?
Sure.
But I have to, I'm also going to make them understand or teach them, not make them understand. That sounds kind of 1984-ish there, doesn't it? To make them understand. No, I'm going to help them understand that, you know, doing cool stuff will make you lose fat and build muscle and feel better and happier and all that stuff. So I try to gently nudge or encourage other goals, like other active things outside of the gym, like playing tennis or boxing or paddleboarding or sort of whatever is active. And then a goal centered around that. And usually if it's a girl and they don't have a goal, I usually say, how about a pull up? And usually they kind of go for that. They're like, wow, you think I can do one? I'm like, yeah.
So could you give like an example of like one of those 4% pie charts, like what that hour would end up looking like?
Sure. I mean, hopefully, you would hope that that hour is spent probably like 25% on, and it depends on the person, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, it's my hour is probably 25% mobility, 25% power work, 25% strength work, and well, probably a little bit more strength and power work and a little bit less endurance. But the truth is, I don't do a lot of gym endurance anyway, because I try to find other fun things to do that will give me that same stimulus. For example, I train jiu-jitsu and I go wakeboarding occasionally, and those are both very and I'm starting to play tennis again, which is cool. Those are both more cardiovascularly demanding. So I don't feel like I need to do a lot of extra conditioning in the gym when I can do something that's fun that also just happens to be conditioning.
I'm trying to lock all my conditioning this summer into swimming at the beach.
Perfect.
That's what I'm trying to do. I mean, I do some sled stuff at the facility, but I consider that more, almost more strength, just because it's like 10-yard marches. It's really not what I would consider to be conditioning or cardiovascular work, whatever the hell you want to call it.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that too, because I understand the reason for high intensity interval training, because it's very efficient. So it's got, to borrow an economics term, it's got a comparative advantage relative to time, because you're getting a lot done in a little amount of time. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't actually have an absolute advantage. You can be much more effective if you spend more time, but structure it differently. Does that make sense?
No, I'm with you.
Okay. Yeah. That's.
I just always looked at it. I was like, I like to train. And I almost like, I'm at the point where I like to like train every day. It's not necessarily very intense every single day, but whether it just be like grabbing a kettlebell and doing like a, you know, a couple sets of swings, a couple of get ups, like that might just be my training for the day, and then walk my dog for an hour, like that could be training. But time efficiency is just so gigantic to me, and I think that's something that we all need to be really conscious of, because of the hour time block that is the personal training session, or even like the semi-private model. Like, it's an hour and maybe an hour and a half if you're dealing with an athlete, and it really doesn't seem like a lot of time when you have to put all that programming together.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a lot of time. That's why it's so important that your planning is really good. That's why you have to. That's why you have to pair exercises together. Honestly.
Yeah, exactly. What else are you reading? Are you reading anything else that's like you think can kind of translate into, you know, the world of fitness or adherence or willpower, any of that stuff?
You know, I read two good books, one fitness and one non-fitness. Well, actually, I read several recently. I read a book called Essentialism, which
I'm almost done with that.
Oh, I thought it was great.
Yeah.
it's funny when he talks about the guy who tries to stop sleeping as much so he can get more out of his day.
The 20-minute naps?
Yeah, I tried to do that with a colossal disappointment.
Wait, you actually try to just like napping 20 minutes every 4 hours?
I tried to do the really short sleep cycles, and I was rewarded 3 days later with a really bad migraine. So I decided to stop doing that. And I've tried it twice in my life, and it was the exact same result. My body basically just said, fuck you. You need to sleep more. And, you know, my best friend, who's a hedge fund manager, he sleeps like 5 to 6 hours a night. He never sleeps more than 6 hours, but he still performs at an optimal level. Mm-hmm. And for me, if I do 5 to 6 hours a night, 3 nights in a row, it's really bad. And, you know, you just kind of have to understand what you're able to do and what you're not able to do. So I liked that book. I thought Essentialism was kind of a great read for anyone, really. And then I read Dan John's book, new one, Can You Go, which I thought was also quite good. Mm-hmm. And he talks a little bit about the same stuff that I'm talking about here, which is you have to consider who the client is first and foremost. Who are they? What is their time investment? What can they expect? You know, that's another thing, is you have to have realistic expectations. And if you make that pie chart, you'll maybe understand what those expectations maybe should be and if your expectations are realistic or not. So you can't compare yourself if you're spending 1 hour every day, which on average is about double what most people are when you look at it at a week of exercise. You're not going to be able to compare yourself to someone who's training 6 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Like it's ridiculous.
Yeah. It's funny that you bring that up because, just this week, the ESPN body issue came out, and, right, almost immediately, as soon as it was hit, like, the internet, like, I started seeing things like people on Instagram and on Facebook. So, like, oh, yeah, like, this is now my new goal. This is my gold standard of how I want to look. And I'm like, they are elite athletes that all they do is, like, especially, like, I think it was Allie Reisman who is the gymnast. Like, she literally trains 6 to 8 hours a day, 7 days a week for one event every 4 years.
Right, and she's been doing that for over a decade. That's what people get. Like you know, it's funny. Someone came into the gym the other day, and I won't say who they are, but they were brand new, and they were kind of disappointed that they weren't already strong enough to do some stuff. And why I thought that was funny was because they hadn't worked out. Mm. And I was like, that would be like me being upset that I don't speak Chinese because I've never tried to speak Chinese. But people go into the gym thinking I should just already be able to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. But it is as ridiculous as me saying, well, you know I've never practiced Chinese or learned Chinese, but I'm kind of pissed off that I can't speak Chinese.
It's like, I've seen a couple of like Jackie Chan movies dubbed. And, you know, I thought, you know, I had a pretty good gist of what was going on, but I guess I didn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, I just, you know, that Jackie Chan, I got new Police Story that's arriving on Blu-ray today from Amazon.com. That's going to be my weekend movie to get some, the guy can still put it together for a great action flick.
You know, maybe you'll speak Chinese at the end of it.
I'm hoping so. I've been doing a lot of Japanese lessons and it's, hasn't stuck as well as I would like it to, but maybe it will translate a little bit when I watch my Jackie Chan stuff. And that's, man, I mean, for us, like, we grew up in like the 90s, man, if you want to talk about some awesome action movies, let's talk Rumble in the Bronx. Let's talk about Jackie Chan First Strike. Oh, so many good movies back from the 90s.
Oh, absolutely. Who am I?
Who am I? Yeah, it's like, come on. Like, this. even this is all pre Rush Hour, and those are pretty good too. But,
well, that guy's an athlete. No matter how you slice, that guy is an athlete. My favorite actually is an old movie. It's actually one of my all time favorite movies. Maybe in like the top one or two is The Legend of Drunken Master.
Of course,
I mean that's the best.
And even he almost carried that character over a little bit in a Western movie that he did. Oh my God, with this like. It was like this white kid who got sucked into some special like world. I don't know if you've seen this one.
No, I haven't.
It's actually pretty good. But anyways, That's it for our Jackie Chan movie segment of the week. But yeah, go check if you haven't. I mean, a bunch of Jackie Chan stuff also on Netflix. If you have Netflix, a bunch of that stuff like Rumble in the Bronx is ready for the viewing. So, you know, let's talk about, you know, how you are getting people stronger. And, you know, things that we're talking about off air were like progressive skill and progressive load. So I'd love if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I kind of like to think of it like there are two separate roads to getting stronger. One is by changing the actual load. So the two examples I like to give are the bench press, which would be a load progressive model, and the planche, which would be a skill progressive model. And I think it's important to have both of those to be the most well-rounded athlete, because one of them, like the bench press, for example, the reason it's so tried and true, or the overhead press or whatever, is because it puts you in the best mechanical advantage to lift the most weight. And lifting large amounts of weights will transform you or make you adapt in a way that doing other things won't. However, doing things like going from a push-up to an L-sit to an L-sit pull through to handstand to a tuck planche to a half-tuck planche to a straddle planche, those are basically still all the same muscles and almost even the same movement, but you're changing the difficulty by developing an entirely new skill. So there are two things that your brain really craves from a motor learning standpoint. One is repetition and the other one is novelty. So I think in order to acquire the best of both worlds from a motor learning standpoint, you need to have something from a repetition standpoint where you're just really enhancing the specific skill of that specific movement. But then I think you also need to be frequently learning new variations on skills to help your brain develop better and help your overall movement literacy increase.
I mean, this is kind of the thing that we always run into is at our facility, like our MBSC system, our program is based on a system of like progressions and regressions and trying to figure out how to, you know, build those into whether you want to call it like a timeline or like a progression regression chart to figure out how we can add those little steps. So it's not just such a huge leap from each one of those. Do you guys have like a pretty similar system to something like that?
Absolutely. I mean, because when we do a class, everyone's doing effectively the same thing.
Right.
So there needs to be lots of options for everybody. You know, I can have a class where I have people doing full front levers, and I have other people who have never done a front lever in their life, let alone hung from a bar in the last 10 years. Yeah. So we need to have the right alternative for those people.
So we got, just for people that want to keep up to date with your stuff, I know you're also putting together an Ultimate Athleticism 2-day workshop. Can you talk a little bit about what that is all about and when it's going to be happening?
Absolutely. We did our first one earlier this year in San Diego. It went really well. It actually sold out. Basically, it's like this. I put all the stuff together that I wish I knew when I first started coaching. There's a big mobility sequence. I talk all about power work, vision exercises, balance exercises, which are, I think, key components to building overall athleticism. I talk about program design. I go specifically over the big four movements from the book, which are L-sit to handstand, front lever, deadlift, and airborne lunge. I talk about accessory work and conditioning your joints to be able to handle loads and, you know, really just how to put it together for the right person. And then what we do at the end is I have everybody actually practice their program design skills. And then I go over and I grade all of them. And I actually sent in the form to see if we can get CEUs for NASM, and it looks promising. So I'm really excited about it, actually.
Awesome. Yeah, no, I think you won't have a problem at all with the NASM stuff. They're great about that. Like one of the best organizations for, you know, CEUs and continuing education stuff. So where else are you looking to have these? Do you have any other dates to announce?
Yeah, I actually have several coming up. I have another one coming up in San Diego at my place in Encinitas, and that one will be on August 22nd and 23rd.
How's the weather out there in August?
It's beautiful here, honestly.
All right.
It's awesome. I mean, you should definitely, you're welcome to come out. I'd love to have you. It's great. Then let's see, gosh, my schedule is actually pretty busy this whole second half of the year. Then the next weekend after that, I'm doing another one in Cartersville, Georgia, mm-hmm. which is right by Atlanta. And then I'm doing another one October 24th and 25th in Munich, Germany, which I think is actually almost already sold out.
Wow.
From what Robert tells me. So,
are you working really with like the Perform Better Europe guys with that?
No, you know, I haven't even talked with Perform Better about it at all, but maybe when we meet in Long Beach, I can put that out there.
Awesome. Yeah. Actually, you know what? I can get you in contact with the Perform Better Europe folks because they're doing lots of great continuing ed out in. I think it's I don't think it's Munich. I think it's I don't know. Anyways, we're actually going out there in September for MBSC stuff too. So
that'd be cool. Yeah, when is Perform Better in Long Beach?
It is August. I have the calendar right here. It is August 6th to August 9th.
Well, if you wanted to stay until the 22nd, 23rd, and move down to San Diego, you're more than welcome.
You know what? I'm thinking about it, and I might make a two trips out there. And we'll talk about this.
Sweet.
We'll talk about this because I think that'd be awesome experience. So where can people go and sign up for the summits?
You know, they can find all the information at maxshank.com. It has my whole calendar of events there where I'm going to be and what I'm up to.
Awesome. Yeah, on there right now. Just go to maxshank.com, click on the calendar events tab on the top, and you will see all those events on there. So anything else that's coming up that people should keep an eye out for? Obviously, you know, we mentioned the Facebook account, and you're also on Twitter, just at maxshank. Anything else?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, just trying to help get the word out there and do what I can.
All right. Well, hopefully you guys are going to be out there at the Long Beach Perform Better Summit, where we can all gang up on Mike and see if we can get some you know, residuals for Max. And, you know, definitely have a good time out there. We got a great social on Friday night where Perform Better fills the place with Bud Light and Budweiser. And hopefully if Chris got my feedback, some Coronas, we'll see. But other than that, that is going to do it for this episode. Again, don't forget to check out the podcast on iTunes. If you subscribe there and submit a review, I would greatly appreciate it. And also, you can follow myself on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinLarrabee. Max is just Max Shank. And I'm even on Instagram now. I'm trying that thing out. So it's just Kevin Larrabee, all one word, on Instagram, because I got bullied from everyone else that's my age saying that I'm too, like, getting, like, I'm an old person for not wanting to use Instagram. So I'm trying to not be an old person, I guess.
You know, I think you're right, though. I mean, Instagram is really important. What I've noticed, actually, is that the attention span is going progressively downward now.
Oh, it's terrible.
You know, I hate to sound like sour apples or sour or whatever it is, but I've written what I consider some awesome articles lately that I think are really, like, meaningful and powerful, and I've gotten some good feedback. But the social response to these awesome articles I write is such a small fraction of me putting up a picture of a handstand that it almost makes me want to go sit in the tub and open a vein. Like, it's just it's so sad sometimes.
So what you got to do is you more or less need to make your articles comic books, and just make it like set like 9 or 10 images with just like a line of text under each of them. And that's the new article, because I was watching Boardwalk Empire. I'm catching up on that. I got HBO Go, and I can't just watch that show. I got to have my damn phone open because I just can't focus on one thing at a time. It's just the world that we live in is just absolutely nuts.
Oh, it's horrifying. I mean, the only way to deliver information, it seems, to the masses is a picture with less than 10 white words on it.
Yeah. Instagram is going to be like sooner or later, you know, the whole like news networks, they're just going to be Instagram, just like a picture or a 15 second video. And that's going to be your news updates. But you know what? You can always just listen to podcasts. You can listen to Audible. That way you can feel like you are doing multiple things at once. Walk your dog, listen to a book, or drive in the car on the way to work. That's how I get a lot of my that's how I get a lot of my reading done. I'm dying, so we're going to stop the show.
Beautiful. Thanks again, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Max, and I'll see you in a couple weeks.
All right. Take care, man.
Having fun. I'm gonna party hard until the sun comes up. The music feels so good. Dancing is what I love. We feel the heat tonight. The mood is feeling right until the sun comes up.